The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com. And we're at 47. Brad's here. Brad, Merry Christmas. What's on your mind today? You wanted to talk about nuts and tires, I guess.
Yeah. What? Bill, Merry Christmas to you.
Thank
you so much for all the good stuff you do, brother. Yeah, so What does wintertime and walnuts have in common? And one of the answers is back in the day, and I'm talking like early 60s till maybe 72 or so, Les Schwab, you know, the legendary tire retailer here in the Pacific Northwest, came up with an affordable alternative to studded tires. And what they did at their plant up in Prineville is they would take tires that had worn past their tread depth, and they would run it through their machine, and they would bond a layer of rubber, special compound that Les came up with that had walnut shells embedded in it.
No kidding! And I have never heard of this. Of course, I wasn't living out here; I was just a kid, you know, in those days. So they had walnut shells embedded into the tire, the rubber compound that was stuck to it.
Right. It was a softer, special winter rubber compound, and of course, the benefit was improved traction. But for people that didn't have a lot of money, and you're going to laugh at me, but back then, you know, you could get a brand new tire for about $25.
Mm-hmm.
But one of these remanufactured tires with a walnut shell cap on the outside of it, you could get for between $15 and $20.
And that was a pretty big deal, though. I mean, $25 for a tire, a big tire back then, that was a lot of money.
Right.
You know, when you were only making what, a couple bucks an hour, maybe at best, maybe a little bit more.
I was making $4.50 an hour back then as an iron worker. So back then, I was making about $4.50 an hour. So I was in tall cotton.
Yeah, but still, it's a lot of money. You'd work a whole day just for two tires, right?
But the real benefit was that if you had studded tires, you could put your studded tires on usually in November, and they had to come off in March. But those walnut shell tires, if you really had to drive on them, you could drive on them all year long because there were no restrictions on driving those walnut shell tires. They were unbelievably popular, and eventually they said remanufactured tires aren't safe or something like that.
Yeah.
But for years and years and years, that was a wonderful alternative that Les Schwab came up with that helped so many people.
I never heard that story. It's a great story. And the other thing is that I would imagine that the walnuts are very tough, but they were much, much gentler on the asphalt, on the pavement, than regular studded tires, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, and they really worked. I mean, and obviously, when Les Schwab made those, he had a very aggressive tread pattern. So you had your highway tires that had, you know, they were designed to get, you know, really good mileage and mm-hmm. be smooth and quiet and all that sort of thing. But the winter tires had a real aggressive tread, and then they had these crushed walnut shells embedded in the rubber, and they really made a big difference in steering and traction.
Now, I would imagine today, if you were to try something like that today, then people would come out, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife would probably come out and say, the shells are invasive species, or else, you know, some wild animal would be eating the shells and then die, and then they would sue Les Schwab out of existence. You know that's how they would do it right now. Yeah, I know. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Bill. Merry Christmas, brother.
But you see, what a creative way of doing it. Now, I would imagine, though, given a softer compound, they probably didn't have lots of miles. You're not going to get 80,000 miles probably out of a recap that would have the walnut shells in the tread. But boy, what a great story, huh?
This hour of the Bill Myers Show is sponsored by Fontana Roofing. For roofing, gutters, and sheet metal services, visit FontanaRoofingServices.com.
Our family at Clouser Drilling has grown tremendously.
Quarter after eight, Dr. Dennis Powers joins us this morning. Christmas Eve and Day 2024. Hello, Doctor. It's good to have you back.
Always a pleasure. And boy, that year has spun so quickly past us. Your listeners, they're saying the same thing. And here we are. looking at a wondrous 2025.
Yeah, you know, I was looking at, you're talking about how 2024 has just flown. I was just installing some software, and I thought that I had just purchased it recently, maybe a couple of months ago. And then and then I'm looking at it when I actually bought it. It was Christmas of last year, and it's been sitting around. Just what are you doing all that time, you know? And it, oh, wait a minute. It was a year ago I bought that here, and now we're getting ready to go into a brand new year for sure. And let's talk about Christmas in the Rogue Valley back in the day, in the pioneer days, 1800s or so. And I don't imagine it was considerably simpler and also a lot tougher in those days. I mean, no heat pumps, no, you know, gasoline powered much of anything, and winters could be pretty brutal, couldn't they?
Well, that's very true. What you had is winters in cold cabins would be tough, and sleet and snow at times would not be that merry. Mm-hmm. But Christmas Eve and day then was a big deal, because even if they just had a small cabin away from any concentration of homes, you know, they would go ahead and they would cut down a small tree and string it with popcorn and small wax candles. They would sing Christmas carols.
I mean, can you believe, though, wax candles on the tree, right?
Yeah.
It's true.
You know that.
You see the pictures.
And what's so amazing about that, my friend, is the fact that you said that you kept a bucket of water close is because those ones really caused a number of blazes when you looked into it. And that would be a heck of a way to go ahead and to celebrate Christmas Eve when your cabin is burned down.
And then even in the 20th century, when we were using electric lights on the Christmas trees at that time, then we decided to burn homes and cabins down with the with those C6 bulbs, you know, those big C6 bulbs.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Plus the fact we never could control our pets. I mean, I can remember a Christmas where it was totally decorated, and we had friends coming over, and it was very Christmassy feeling. We had a dog then that decided just to jump on the tree. I just watched as the tree came over.
Oh, hey, there are whole channels on YouTube and Facebook that are based on animals, especially cats and Christmas trees. Have you found those by chance? I know you have cats at home.
I would love to. I will look at that, because the thing about cats, as we know so well, is the fact that they like to climb trees where they are.
Yep.
I could just see that. We have three rag dolls, which are just perfect for us. We've had dogs, we've had kids, we've had everything, on our phase of life. And you're absolutely right. Cats can be amazing. You can't keep them off of furniture, but then you figure a way of living with it.
Listen, you can get a cat to behave as long as the cat wants to behave. But the cat has to want to behave. That's all. Otherwise, a cat just does what a cat will, I guess. All right. Back, though, on the pioneer days, though. I mean, back then, cats were actually working animals for sure, rather than just mere pets. But so you're inside, you got your popcorn laced tree, you got the red madrone berries on it, and then they would sing Christmas carols and read from the Bible. It was a pretty simple time, though, overall, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And even as you had concentration, small towns like Golden or Gold Hill, et cetera, Grants Pass, once the railroad came through, you would have a community tree. All these little towns that were growing that now are major places, Ashland, Medford, Grants Pass, we had, in the early days, we would have like 1860s, 1870s or so, you'd have a community tree and little presents that would be put for the children.
What kind of trees or what kind of gifts were usually fashioned and were given to the kids in those days?
Well, it depended. A lot of times, since we didn't have trade with China, we'd go ahead.
No Amazon stagecoach coming in those days, right?
Yeah, that's right. You'd have hand-carved toys. You would have probably some little candy treats that are put in.
Mm-hmm.
But, you wouldn't have the oranges that you and I would have growing up, because they were a real treat, when we were growing up.
Yeah, well, the big deal, I remember that Linda's parents, who had her when they were, quite old, in their 40s, is when she was born, late arriving baby at that point. they would talk about a Christmas in which they received an orange. And that was like a precious gift because you just never saw an orange in those days.
That's right. And even after you had concentrated orange juice, you would have oranges put in from the tradition of it. And then, of course, candy canes. And as we grow, you know, further into today, you would have all these. Do you remember ballpoint pens? I would always have stuffers of ballpoint pens.
Yeah, and there was a time that that ballpoint pens were kind of a big deal and not as ubiquitous. Everything was more, stuff that we think of and just kind of take for granted was more of a bigger deal, you know, in those days. A lot of homemade gifts, and let's see, if you're in a town like Gold Hill, you talk about people would come out and they would decorate the whole town. The kids would come out, right? Town.
And you'd even have that in Ashland. You'd even have that in other cities at that time. And then as
Was that next to decorating the pride flag and the pride tree? Did they have the Christmas tree and the pride tree in Ashland at that day in the 1800s or not? I don't know.
Well, you know, the good news is that that's an abominesque type of deal, and you're absolutely right. And part of the thing too is that although it was more difficult in those times, it was in a way less controversial. It was one of where people would really look at Christmas for the way Christmas is supposed to be.
And by the way, the whole culture in those days was pretty much, there was no questioning the culture that it was a Christian culture at that time. Would that be fair to talk about those days?
Yeah, plus the fact that the idea of nativity scenes was not as politicized, you know, where every fool, every cult progressive would get their knickers in a twist over that, because all the communities, regardless of your religion, it was part of something that you enjoyed in these towns.
Now entertainment options were smaller, or shall we say, less often. I mean, entertainment, you had to kind of provide yourself, whether you were singing or playing instruments and doing the Christmas carols, in those days of the Christmas. But the big city of Medford, which had maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people at that point, right? Was it that big? Or?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, in 1885, we have a quote there that has to do about the grand ball that they had in Byers Hall.
The grand Christmas ball, right? Will be
That's
in Byers
right.
Hall.
A fine supper and best of music is provided. First class caller has been engaged.
Oh, for square dancing, right? For the square dancing. Okay.
And it'd be really smaller, Bill, and tickets for $250. But the key thing on that one is that you probably had about maybe 2,000 people at the time, because the railroad had just swung in about a year before, and it took time to go from, a settlement of tents that was hardly anyone up to where you'd have actually structures. But the other thing that was amazing about this, my friend, was the fact that they had 90 people that showed up, which on a percentage basis would be the equivalent, I was working that out in my mind the other day, equal to about 20,000 people now in the percentage of the population. But
no kidding.
And the ticket proceeds were going because they wanted to get a new school.
Oh, so I was wondering about that, because the tickets for the big Christmas ball then, and this is 1885, $2.50, that was huge money in 1885, wasn't it?
Yeah, that really was. And then what was interesting, though, is that at that same year, you would have, for example, the same type of thing for New Year's Eve with, a violinist, and you would have these things. Now, meanwhile, Ashland, which would be around the same time, was much smaller, even Emory, who was a real big name here, at their various cabins, they would just have, they took a donation and they'd buy little gifts for the children with a tree, and then they'd go hunting in the afternoon. So there are all these different things that are happening there. But, the other thing that really marked it for me was that if you then took a look at the time that changes, that gets into past into the Depression, the commercialization was something that really, really stood out to me because I took a look at.
Yeah, when did it really? When did it start becoming a little more commercialized? And when I was a little boy, the Charlie Brown Christmas special first came out. That was 1965 when that first aired. Christmas of 1965, right. And I was a 4-year-old at that time.
Right.
And I remember that, you know, understanding that they were complaining in that special in 1965, almost 60 years ago, they were complaining about the overly commercialized Christmas then. When did it really start getting there, right? And because some would say that, you know, commercialization at that point, you know, they weren't doing Christmas displays in September at Costco, which I think is how they do it now.
Well, you know what was so amazing, though, is that, you know, for kids growing up, you know, you see Santa Claus and you have dreams of presents and you have Charlie Brown, you have all these things.
Yeah.
But basically, as an adult, you'd be having all these type of commercials. And as soon as you had newspapers that were going ahead and delivered, like I took a look at what was the successor to the Grants Pass Courier from, probably about 1890 up until 1930, just, you know, taking a look. I was amazed at all the advertisements and the same thing in Ashland that had to do for typewriters, clothing, furniture, shoes.
So it's really nothing new. The commercialization of the holiday, you said, is nothing all that new about the last 100 years or so. Would that be a way, way of looking at it?
And the reason for it is it just makes a lot of sense because if this is a place where you're talking about giving and Christmas gifts, mm-hmm. and thinking about saving up for what you can give your wife, you're going to be buying things. And so all the way along, you have this type of trend going through, and then it depends on, you know, how much your budget is. It depends on what you want to do. And even now, we're getting away from the traditions, for example, that the home-cooked dinner, which was one of the things I remember so vividly, you know, which was a lot of time for the mm-hmm. homemaker. Now, there was a study that came out that said like 44% wanted to have pizza because you could sit and watch the football games. So you have all these different things that are coming through.
The tradition of the Christmas meal is different now. It's true because even we're doing something different. We always have a traditional Christmas Thanksgiving meal, you know, in our home. It was a big deal. That's very special, you know, the dressing and turkey, even though doesn't like turkey all that much, and cranberry, and we like that. But we're really actually erring towards what my mother wants this year. My mother's 84, and she's a woman from the South. I mean, she came from the South. All her relatives came from the South. And so we're making a Christmas dinner for her, essentially, and it's going to be a big brisket, barbecued brisket, with a homemade cornbread, a nice sweet cornbread, by the way, not a savory cornbread, and baked potatoes and a homemade banana cream pie. You know, that's going to be, it may not be considered a traditional one, but we know that, I mean, it's firing on all the cylinders for her, so that's what we're planning on doing.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Let's see now. Are invitations going out?
You'll be coming a little later in the week, though. You know that. We'll see you Saturday, all right, Doc?
That's really a great, great home-cooked meal, I have to tell you. And I think we're going to be having a Cornish game hen.
Cornish game hen.
Easier to do.
Oh.
Yeah, it's really good because actually you can get about two of them for about $12, and it's simpler. So in other words, as we get older, you know, there are different things. And of course, in long-term wonderful relationships like you and Linda, and I've been so fortunate to enjoy this with Judy, is that there's always these little give and takes that you do.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always gone ahead and said, hey, honey, if you want. I was able to do it one time. We had a number of people coming over, and we both were caught with our jobs, where I said, look, I'll go ahead and I'll bring a Safeway. You know, they got the turkey and the cranberry and the sauce, and they have all these different mashed potatoes. And as soon as I started bringing it in, I could just see, I think next year we'll do something differently.
Yeah, it doesn't work all that well. What was the worst? Can you think of the worst holiday meal you ever had? I can't.
Yeah. That was funny. Because what they decided to do, as we're packing away what I'd brought, was that they decided one of them had brought a turkey because they had heard about what my little plan was. And so they put it into the oven, but the stove broke. So they then...
Turkey tartare doesn't work all that well, does it?
And so they went to a neighbor's house who had been invited and started cooking it over there. Meanwhile, you had rain coming in. And I was sitting there just saying, God, I love this. As long as I don't have to make the trips, you know, try to cook that turkey.
I have no problem finding out what was the worst holiday meal I ever had. And this is not to speak ill of the dead, all right? But it was a Thanksgiving meal that I had at the old Sherry's restaurant. And, of course, the whole chain shut down recently.
Oh, that's right.
But when I when we moved back to the Rogue Valley from Fargo, after I finally got extricated from all of that big mess back in the days, this is 2001. Thanksgiving, wow. 2001. We didn't have anything really set up at that point, and so okay, well, let's go and we'll go and have Christmas dinner or Thanksgiving dinner there, and it was most of those diners at that time, they were not doing the best Christmas dinner. It was kind of like canned gravy. You know what I'm getting at? The canned gravy and the canned potatoes and a slice of deli turkey, which, oh boy, that was probably the worst food. I still like, though, the company, though. That was, and I guess that's really all that matters for the holidays.
Yeah, you know, we've had all these, and I'm sure your listeners, can think and have had, and friends that we know who listen in, is that, you know, you have all these different things as part of the holidays, and I think for us, our kids grew and headed off with their own careers and their own lives, we would change a bit, and we then, on terms of trees, we went to, I tried this a couple times, you know, real small, like 4-footer.
Mm-hmm.
But then I decided one time to try to get a plastic one that would work. Well, that is stuffed away somewhere in a storage unit right now.
Yeah, we haven't had a Christmas tree for about a decade. We haven't had one for about a Christmas. We have one sitting out in the garage, but, the main issue that we had is that one cat would always climb it, and the other cat would always eat the plastic off the Christmas tree. So one way, it just wasn't good. So we decided we just decorate is what we do now, all right? So anyway, Christmas Eve and Day 2024, Dr. Dennis Powers, we'll get that up there. Doc, we haven't even talked about the Neiman Marcus, but it's okay. The wealthy people can check that out and see where they can buy this year, okay?
That's true, and we didn't even get a car this year.
No, no.
Instead of that wonderful Mustang for $85,000 a few years ago, they threw in a $1.9 million carriage for a kid that dates back to the 18th century, of which there's only three of them in the world. I miss my car.
Yeah, but a royal horse-drawn carriage is in Neiman Marcus. It's only $1.9 million. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. What could go wrong? We'll put that all up. Hey, Doc, hang on. We'll have a little more talk about that. We'll take it from the past to the present to the really present, and maybe we talk a little bit of lawfare, too, okay? All coming up.
That sounds like a winner.
All right. This is the Bill Myers Show. Dr. Powers will return in just a bit here. And on the Bill Myers Show. Now, what has been going on with physical gold and silver, I haven't been checking the price recently. It's been kind of in that $2,650, $2,700, and it really broke through resistance earlier this year, as you know. Of course, the markets are down today. I don't know. Still, I'm looking at gold as a long-term play because the one thing I think you can be assured of in the United States, and frankly, the Western democracies, inflation, the Western welfare states, in spite of all of the efforts, and I'm hoping Trump is successful in helping tamp down some of that issue. The long-term play, inflation, and that is where gold and silver shine. Talk to Jay Austin and Company, gold and silver buyers in Ashland, 1632 Ashland Street. You can talk with them today. Get some. Whoever you're looking at the current value you want to sell, they sell. It's very simple. It's very honest. Just, okay, how much gold do you have? Here's what it costs. There's always a bit of a premium on top of that. And they're the best people in this area to deal with. I've been trading with them for years. And I hope you will, too. They also are a big supporter of talk radio, which I'm also a fan of, too, as you could imagine. 1632 Ashland Street in Ashland, 6th and G in downtown Grants Pass. Call 482-3715. FortuneReserve.com if you wanted to buy online. But, you know, I think just the conversation with talking with Mark and Andre and everybody that works at Jay Austin is so great. Just drop by and talk to him today. JayAustinBrokers.com, FortuneReserve.com.
This is Brent with Home and Built Deck and Fence. Many customers in the Rogue Valley ask why winter is a great time for deck.
You're hearing the Bill Myers Show on 106.3 KMED.
841, getting ready to settle down for a long winter's nap here for about a week or so. And that means sleeping till 6, maybe 6:30. But yeah, I'll be taking a week off or so. And it's kind of nice. I always do this at the end of the year. There's not a lot going on in the talk radio world. Maybe different this time around. Of course, you know what's happened. You know what'll happen, Dr. Powers. You go on vacation at the end of the year because not much usually goes on. But and that's when, of course, World War III bursts out, and then I have to come back. But we'll see what happens. I'll get back to you on that, okay?
And you've experienced that before.
Yeah.
A well-earned, deserved few days off.
Well, I remember there was a time that I was going to have go on vacation. It was Labor Day weekend when the Olmeda fire broke out. And I was actually on vacation and just came back because someone said, well, there's a fire down in Ashland. We're all thinking, okay, they'll get it handled. That didn't work out so well, as you can recall.
Hmm. Yeah, and I remember that one. That was actually the one I was thinking about, was the Alameda fire, for starters, when you were mentioning about conflict.
Yeah, and there was definitely a lot of conflict here. Hey, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions. I want to ask, this is just a question on the law, the basic law. Now, I know you're a former professor of business law at Southern Oregon University, so I'm just going to kind of throw this at you. I've had a bunch of anonymous people that have sent me claims that there are cameras inside the Portland Loos up in Grants Pass, in the city of Grants Pass. City of Grants Pass says there's absolutely no truth to this, but you know those really expensive stainless steel toilets to help prevent from being destroyed by the raving lunatic homeless that are drug addicted? You know those, right? Those. And there's a little box inside them. City says it's a sensor to turn lights on. It's an infrared sensor. Other people are insisting that they are cameras. I can't answer one way or the other. I'm going to take the city's word at it at this point until there's bigger evidence on something like that. But is there any law? I mean, as long as you aren't actually exposing the biological ends of things, I mean, is there anything wrong with actually taking you know, if there were pictures being taken of people that go into the bathroom, even if it's about trying to find out who's going in and out, so that way, you know, if there was vandalism, we know who to talk about. I don't know if what the law would say about something like that. I understand not having anything in the stalls, for sure. You know, I get that. I understand that.
Oh, right. Yeah, and actually, there's no quote-unquote right to privacy in the Constitution, but it's been one that over time has been implied,
but certainly there would be privacy for the relieving of your, you know, of your biological faculties, you know, that kind of, or facilities.
That's true, and they make also a distinction of public versus such as outdoors, you know, where anyone can go in and damage versus you know, at a retailer. Mm-hmm. And so you have these distinctions that come in, and the key thing is that in today's still woke situation, all you need is a few people who go ahead and they say, oh, this is violating my rights, mm-hmm. because and then a call to the ACLU, and then they go ahead. This is really, I've seen this happen over decades.
What if there, I'm going to engage in a little bit of what-if-ism, all right? It's just a legal exercise for you, since you're the one big legal brain I talk to every week, okay? All right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What if, now, the reason why they put, you know, blue lights and black lights into all of these places is because you have so many homeless that are using these bathrooms as shooting dens for illicit drugs, right? And there's all sorts of problems, and you don't want to tar everybody like this with the problems. But the reason why we have these kind of these bathrooms is because the regular bathrooms have been getting destroyed. You know, I've heard about you know, people. Homeless here in Southern Oregon, they would go into a department store or a restaurant and practically steal every piece of toilet paper and or towels in there. They would, you know, rip the soap dispensers off the walls. And then, you know, you know, this is what we're having to deal with. And so, yeah, you want to provide a service. But on the other hand, we I don't think you have a constitutional right to tear up someone's bathroom. You just don't. And what if you were to have, they snap your picture when you're going into the loo, then you come out, and then it snaps another picture of the interior. So that if somebody did something bad, we know who did it, because it's only one person at a time gets to go in, from what I recall. What do you think? Would that pass?
That's a good suggestion. The two things. One is that the ACLU would probably go ahead and sue on some aspect of saying that you didn't advise this homeless person of their rights. And we've seen what's happened in New York City in terms of not enforcing laws. And on the other hand, you'll have the argument that comes in that says, oh, wait a minute, this is in a place where only the homeless can go, and we're just trying to take care of it in terms of safeguarding it. But you know what I'm remembering, Bill? I'm remembering here in Ashland, where in the motel that was converted for the homeless, the homeless would come in at night and then steal everything for drugs. That wasn't, because we have this insidious.
Yeah, everything that wasn't nailed down. Everything that wasn't nailed down. Yeah, exactly.
And take it out. And then, so what they did, the city, was to put up bars. And then the ACLU started complaining, oh, this is a prison. And what happens in a fire? There's almost no win when you have people who are woke. Seriously, and this is the problem that we have, and that's where the Alliance Defending Freedom is needed to come into these cases.
All right, now let me just ask you this:
but I don't think it will go without having some person bring it up in a city council meeting and start making a big deal about it. Because all you need is a couple of people who are woke to try to make it very tough on the rest of us.
You think that there might be a case then? Because I know that there are some cities, not necessarily here in Southern Oregon, because the laws are a little more strict, but they've said, you'll ask them, what kind of services do you provide for homeless? And they will say, we provide none. And it makes you wonder if you're almost better dealing off with someone going to the bathroom on the sidewalk than providing the $200,000 clean loo at taxpayer expenses and then still having to deal with the drug addicts shooting up and such. I don't know. It's horrible to even have to bring those things up. But that's the reality of what many of the cities and downtowns face because of our lack of wanting to deal with the issues.
Yeah, and you see, it also depends on what state we're in. I mean, we just have the misfortune to be in a very unsound political environment with the far left.
And there's a lot of political risk in 2025 in the state of Oregon. You got to figure that out
That's exactly right. And then also, just in terms of the allocation of monies, in terms of when you were mentioning, Bill, about the overpass over I-5, actually in that overpass, we've been doing fine for all these years, but you have this activism that comes in, like you have on the homeless, and you have people there that have very cushy jobs advocating for animals, not to say that it's totally bad, but on the other hand, they get paid monstrous salaries to do this. And my first thought when I was listening to your comment on it, in terms of the news, was that, oh, I can just see us driving now and saying to Judy, hey, I think I might see one deer. Mm-hmm. And why isn't that money used for the middle class tax cuts? It's this type of thing that we have here in Oregon that makes it so difficult. But if you go to other states that I stay in touch with, they have a sounder way of looking at things rather than trying to go ahead and try to make it to Washington, D.C. Now they're not going to do it because Trump beat the chameleon.
I wanted to ask you, speaking of the federal government, you were talking about, kind of implying what could be happening with Trump's middle-class tax cut. I was talking with Rick Manning last week, and I was asking him if he thought that Speaker Johnson would survive what happened last week. And he said that he better. And I thought that was an interesting answer, and I asked him why. And he says that if Speaker Johnson doesn't survive, Trump's agenda will essentially be dead in 2025 because they'll spend too much time trying to find another speaker. And nobody really wants to be speaker, at least not the people that would actually possibly get voted in. Any thoughts on that?
I like the answer because it really mirrors what I would say. The reason is that in the beginning, almost sounds like the Bible.
The Bible,
it's a cherished book. But basically, he, being Trump, is going to be running down, you know, using executive decrees. That's the easiest thing to do. It's going to be front-ended.
Yeah, but that's not going to be a long-term fix if you don't get legislation, as you well know. The next,
that's right.
Yeah, the next loser Democrat that gets in could reverse what he does, right?
Well, that's going to be 4 years down the road.
True.
But you see, my friend, what's going to happen, though, is that they're going to try to do whatever they can to start working for the tax cuts where it expires towards the end of the year.
Because they need some certainty. Businesses need some certainty for planning in order to be able to decide where you invest or don't invest, as the case might be, right?
Well, it's one of the campaign promises that makes sense given the absurd actions of Biden in his last days, if you will. But I think the other thing is that this is something where the Democrats, even though it's been hijacked by the far-left tribe, know that they've got to come in with something, and then they're going to be fighting, for example, to go ahead and get back in the deduction for, interest.
For state taxes. And
state
in other words, they call them SALT taxes, S-A-L-T, right?
Right. And so you're going to have these negotiations going through. This is one to where even the Democrats are going to need to go ahead and come together. And it's a question of to what extent we're going to get the cuts that are for the middle class versus the ones that have to do because – you know, the far left and the Democratic Party has lurched to the left. But on the other hand, those people there know they've got to go ahead and not talk about raising taxes. They already went ahead and blew one election over their approach. They want to blow another one. But
yeah, they're kind of off the they're kind of out in the wilderness right now. It's kind of where they're going to be. But I wouldn't count on them being in the wilderness for very long. Okay.
No, and you're going to see it in terms of lawsuits, because right now what's happening is the fact that this core of the Democratic Party that was hijacked by the far left have so much at risk as to monies, as to salaries, as to deep state, as to where they can go to earn the monies that they've gotten used to, that they're not going to be in that much of a compromising mode, and they're going to be using all these types of things from the ACLU to far-left Democrat sources.
Yeah, in other words, get the popcorn then for that. Let me ask you then, in your opinion, I'm concerned about, I don't trust Elon Musk. Nobody should trust Elon Musk because Elon's ultimately out for Elon. And the fact that he said some decent things about Trump, that's okay. You know, that's all fine and good. But I do not think of him as an ally. And I got a little bit concerned that essentially he's the one that ended up blowing up that spending deal last week, which was a bad spending deal. But I get concerned that the perception will be that there's undue influence with the president. I would rather the president blow it up. What say you?
Well,
Doc? Hello, Doc?
Well, if it wasn't for Elon Musk, we wouldn't have probably had as great a win for Trump as not. And this is
okay.
A great far-left argument saying, and it's already coming through in all, like MSNBC that has, you know, ratings in the toilet.
Yeah, the co-president. Yeah.
Yeah, and they're doing this because they are frightened as hell about Musk, because he has the ability to come in, and if he sets in to swim in to cut government, he's going to do whatever he can. He's already on record as putting in monies into different Democratic strongholds to help moderate Democrats win, which is opposed to Soros. This is
okay, but tell me though how that isn't any more fascistic than what Soros was doing.
Oh, because the fact that Soros hates democracy, or Soros is the only one I know that's underneath indictment overseas for what he did over there with Britain and France.
Yeah,
Soros is a communist. Period. And Musk, this is a great way. If people are very diehard Republicans, they will be threatened by you.
Okay. Well, my concern when I see Trump's going to need all the friends that he can. All right. In order to get his agenda moving through. Musk is not a political guy. Musk is on the spectrum. He admits this. Musk is the biggest equivalent of a human computer that we probably ever had close to power. Okay? Can you agree with me on that so much? You know, there's not a shred of empathy in that guy. Musk also made his entire fortune off of grifting from the government with the carbon taxes and the electric vehicle things. And now he says he's okay with cutting all of that now that he's the one with the $200 billion. You know, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. You know, Bill, I have a slightly different take, and the reason is...
Okay, what's that?
Thanks to Judy, I read the biography about Elon Musk mm-hmm. as to where he came from and where he got his money, and it was brilliant. Involving what really basically became eBay / PayPal and the monies that he did to start up without any government help to start up Tesla and to do SpaceX. And what he was able to do is something that's amazing.
Oh, yeah, I agree. But he did it with taxpayer money for the most part.
No, it wasn't there.
No, Tesla would never have survived without the taxpayer grift. Without the forced taxpayer grift.
No, because you see, part of the thing is, I have a slightly different take there.
Okay.
In reading the biography, and Erickson did a wonderful job on that, a master job, should have gotten a Pulitzer Prize. You see all the ins and outs of why Tesla became where it did before he was going ahead and getting the help of the tax credits starting from scratch. And you see, the arguments that are being made are really coming from the far left because of the fact that they are frightened by Musk and my friend, not being a politician is the reason why he's doing that job.
Okay, I'm concerned about Musk too, but maybe for a different reason, not because I'm frightened like they are. But frankly, I don't want the guy who wants to put a chip in my brain ultimately. And that's what he's advocated, you know, the Neuralinks and things like that, pushing a lot of policy in my government.
And I appreciate your arguments, Bill. I really do. We've been able to discuss these things for decades. The other thing is, in that biography, and you could see in terms of AI, he is the one that started OpenAI and then had and left it because he didn't want it to be going ahead and become a for-profit one, which is the fight going on now.
I remember that.
But instead, my friend, what he said, it should belong to all the people because that's the only way that we're going to be able to contain this and not have the problems. So I have a slightly different take. I understand the feelings that are happening. And I support the points that you're bringing up. But on the other hand, there are other points that come in. Reading the biography, my friend, and Merry Christmas to you is one that...
And Merry Christmas to you too, Doctor. And you have a wonderful... Well, take a week off, and we'll talk after the new year, all right? You be well, okay? Thanks
and
again.
And be well, be good, be safe, and all of our take care to you and Linda.
All right. Once again, Dr. Dennis Powers, retired professor of business law, and we will talk after the holidays, my friend. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and we'll catch you then. This is The Bill Meyer Show.
Stephen Westfall, Inc. is thrilled to announce the winner of their second metal roof giveaway for a well-deserving veteran. After sifting through countless inspiring nominations, it's with great pleasure that the Westfalls reveal Michael K. of Rogue River as the winner of a top-of-the-line metal roof. To everyone who nominated a veteran, your heartfelt stories touched our hearts, and we appreciate your support. Once again...